โมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอปารุตาเตสังฆมตัสสะดวาราเยโสตวันโตปมัญจตุสะดานติOkay, very good. So for this evening's talk, I'd like to talk about a group of dhammas that we call the five spiritual faculties, the Pancindriyani. And these five spiritual faculties, you should all know them off by heart. If you don't, you should feel guilty. You haven't done your homework. Anyway, hopefully by the end of this evening's talk, you will remember them, and I will repeat them many times so that you will get it into your head. Number one is sadha, faith. Virya, energy. Mindfulness. Sati. Samadhi is, well, it's just samadhi. We're not going to translate that. And panya, wisdom or understanding. Okay? So faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. So these are one of the most commonly taught sets of dhammas we find that Buddha teaching, and very useful and a very pragmatic group of qualities to think about when we're developing our meditation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what these things mean and how we practice them and so on and so forth. So first of all, what's the idea of we've translated this word as indriya, as faculty. Actually, the Pali word is indriya. Which has quite a strong faculty, doesn't quite cover it. It's a bit of a strange word in Pali, but it's actually related to the word Inda, meaning like a lord. Indra being one of the great gods of the Rig Veda, some gods of the tradition. So it's almost like lordship or something like that, word Indriya, but we translate it as a faculty. But it actually has something, has a very neutral quality to it, whereas Indriya has quite a sort of powerful or positive quality to it. remember that after the Buddha's awakening, one of the first things that he did after he got enlightened was to say, whatever, why bother even trying, right? This is what the Buddha did. After all this practice and meditation, he basically gave up. He said, look at that mob, they're just so messed up. Right? He didn't use those exact words, okay? That's a paraphrase, but it was the general sense of it, right? So everyone is just so lost, you know? Suffering is so great and the defilements are so strong. How can it be possible that we can ever, you know, that I can ever share this, you know? I've practiced so hard, you know? And the Buddha's like, you know, I'm the Buddha. I'm like really good at what I do, you know. I'm a really good meditator and stuff. And even I found it so hard to do it. What about all of these other losers? Anyway, so it's a very interesting moment in the history of Buddhism, right? Everything's like balanced on this kind of knife's edge. Maybe the Buddha's just going to say, nah, I'll just go away and do some meditation and be peaceful. And that's good enough. Yeah, I'm enlightened already. Hey, why bother about anyone else? And then, of course, according to the legend, the way that it's taught, then the great god of the Brahmanical tradition, Mahabrahma himself, comes down and on bended knee before the Buddha begs him, please teach the Dhamma. There are those who will listen. There are those who will understand. And so then the Buddha used his psychic powers. So the Buddha, so they say, had this ability to be able to read people's minds and see what their spiritual potential was. And then he said that there were beings with little dust in their eyes. And beings with much dust in their eyes and those with little dust in their eyes. And there are beings with faculties that are underdeveloped, poorly developed, and those with faculties are well developed. And the word that uses here is indriya. So those whose indriyas are already showing signs of potential. And so because of that, he then took the opportunity to tell Brahma, yes, I will go and I will teach. So, you know, you might think, right, you know, a lot of the times when we come to spiritual practice, and we tend to be quite, you know, meditation, we sit in meditation, and we think about this and think about that, and mind's all over the place and stuff, and we tend to think, oh, you know, I'm not really good, I'm not a really good meditator, you know, and these kinds of things. But in fact, the people here today and the people watching this on live streaming or on YouTube, you are the ones with little dust in your eyes. Yeah? Okay, maybe not everyone. I don't know all of you individually, right? And I'm not like the Buddha, okay? Just don't get any ideas. I'm not reading your mind and telling you whether, you know, figuring out your spiritual faculties or anything like that. But on the whole, right, people who come to this kind of group and who come to this meditation, they're people who have that interest in purifying their mind, in living a good life, the interest in learning and wisdom and all of those things. So you are the people, really, who have those little dust in your eyes. And the Buddha, he would always empower people. This is one of the great things right from the start of Buddhism. And it's one of the things for me which radically distinguishes Buddhism from many other religions and spiritual paths. And so often, when we come to a spiritual path, we find that it's all about a kind of dependence, right? You always have to rely on God or rely on a church or rely on some guru or rely on this or rely on that to actually help you. And you're told, you're by yourself, you're useless, you can't do it. And this is one of the core things to the Buddha's idea, that he saw that there were beings who had that potential. There's one passage which we find in the Sutta Nipata. It's very interesting. And somebody comes to the Buddha and asks him, please teach me, bring me across, carry me over to the far shore. And the Buddha says to him, I am not able to carry someone over to the far shore. But you yourself, with your mindfulness and your energy, if you practice, you yourself can make it over to the far shore. This is the Buddha's teachings. Yeah? It's not a teaching of dependence. It's not a teaching of relying on some guru or anything like that, all these kind of initiations and all of this kind of stuff. That's not real Buddhism. Real Buddhism, you yourself can cross over because of your own efforts, your own mindfulness, your own wisdom. So when the Buddha did this, he began to teach, and he began to try to find those who had little dust in their eyes, who had good, strong faculties, and to teach them, to bring them to the Dhamma. So this gives us an idea of what this first of these faculties means, faculty of faith. And this is a word which is quite, you know, a bit dicey to try to translate these days. Some people are not very comfortable with the idea of faith. Right? A lot of people, especially in Western countries, people come to Buddhism usually because they've been traumatized by faith. Right? I mean, maybe not usually, but certainly a lot of people have. They're disillusioned with it. They've had enough. They don't want more of these rituals and ceremonies and things like that. They don't want to be told to believe. They want to know for themselves. You see, there's this idea in the way that this idea of faith has developed in the West. It's almost this idea that to believe in something is more powerful than to know it. Like it's better to have faith in something is an emotional commitment, which is somehow more meaningful than the actual facts. That's how faith takes precedence. This is a very kind of strange idea, and it's certainly not the Buddhist idea of faith. So to understand the Buddhist idea of faith, we need to sort of take a step back, step out of a kind of theistic framework or the way that we've been used to thinking about it in religious areas, and just sort of look at how faith was applied within Buddhism. First thing to understand is the Buddha made a distinction between two kinds of faith. One kind of faith he called andhasadha, blind faith. Right? So we all know what blind faith is. Yeah? Follow the leader. Trust me, the leader says. Right? Just do whatever I say, yeah, and then you'll be right. You don't think for yourself. Don't, you know, don't question me. Don't argue. Right? You just do what I say, have faith in what I say, do that, and then you'll be okay. This is blind faith. And this is the faith that the Buddha criticized. His faith is not Buddhist faith. And if you hear anybody teaching in this way, they're not teaching you Buddhism. Anybody who tells you, don't question, don't make trouble, right? Obey. This is not Buddhism. This is against the Dhamma. Real faith in Buddhism is akaravati sadha. So I'm quoting from the Pali here because I want you to understand that when I'm explaining this, I'm not just making stuff up, right? I'm not just pretending that somehow these ideas are Buddhist ideas and it's really just me being modern and Western because I'm a Westerner and this is how I think, right? Right? Actually, these are words we find in the Pali canon used in exactly the sense that I'm explaining it. Akaravati sadha literally means reasoned faith. Okay? So akaravati sadha is a faith that comes from investigation and inquiry. To know, to look at the causes for things, the reasons for it, to understand it. This is the Buddhist way and this is the Buddhist faith. It's very interesting that when the Buddha talked about these different kinds of faculties, then he sometimes would teach things in terms of opposites and antidotes, right? So if you have a certain problem, then you can develop another quality as an antidote for that, right? And most of those are fairly straightforward, right? So for example, if you have anger, then the antidote for anger is loving kindness, right? If your problem is your mind is restless, then the antidote to that is to do breathing meditation to calm your mind, and so on. One of those the Buddha mentions is doubt. He says, "What's doubt? Sometimes is a problem. You're sitting and meditating, your mind's running here and there, thinking, worrying about things. Is this right? Is this wrong? Should I be doing it like this way or that way? And you're having doubts." And he said, "What is the antidote to doubt?" And of course, the obvious thing to say is the antidote to doubt is faith. But actually, what it says is the antidote to doubt is inquiry. Right? The opposite of doubt is inquiry. It's very, very interesting, isn't it? Because often this is what we think. We think that if you inquire and so on, you create more doubts. Yeah? I had a friend who's a Buddhist monk. He used to, before he was a monk, he studied theology at a university in England, and he said that the joke in the sort of the departmental joke was that studying theology was the fastest way to make you lose your religion. Right? So this is what sometimes we think. People are afraid to inquire. They don't like it. They feel threatened by it. I'm constantly astonished to see intelligent, educated people who have been practicing Buddhism for many years who are horrified by the idea that you might actually inquire and actually use your mind in the Dhamma. There's one example just recently. A good friend and supporter, Dhiriyupa, was helping us do some work with some of the suttas in Thai. And she noticed that some of the suttas were inconsistent. In some places they would say, "The Buddha said," and then they'd have something the Buddha said. It might be like a dialogue between the Buddha and somebody else. But then the text was edited inconsistently, so in other places it wouldn't say that. So it was a bit unclear who was speaking. So she said, should she put the Buddha said back in there so that it's clear how the passage is structured, right? It seems to be a fairly minor editorial kind of decision to make. And she mentioned that to one of her friends in Thailand, and the friend was so horrified and said, "You will go to hell." Right? Not just it's bad editorial practice or something like that. You will go to hell for that. Right? This is how people think. This is how not a few people think. A lot of people think like this. And so, but this is completely against the Buddhist tradition, Buddhist teachings. So the Buddhist teachings all about inquiry. So the fastest way in Buddhism to create faith is to inquire. To ask questions, to learn, to research, to investigate. This is how we gain faith in Buddhism. So that our faith, on the one hand, has an emotional component. I mean, faith itself is an emotion. You know, and we can see that there's something quite beautiful about that emotion of faith. Right? When you see somebody who's acting in a way, you know, if you see somebody who's, you know, going to church and they feel very, you know, it's like entering that sacred space, or you know, you see like somebody coming into the temple and bowing and offering the flowers at the shrine, or and these kinds of, you know, gestures of faith, they're quite beautiful, they're very kind of gentle and quite touching. But we have to be careful that that faith is not just an emotional thing, but also it connects with our reason. Faith should be what aids our reason, what supports it. And there's an unfortunate tendency in our world to see that the faith and reason, religion and science, are at war with each other. And this tendency is something which is purely a Western invention. It was never the case in the Eastern religions. Not only Buddhism, but also in Hinduism, Taoism, and just generally speaking in that sphere. Faith and religion, faith and wisdom were always supporting each other. They're not something which are fighting against each other. So in that kind of sense, faith perhaps is not the best translation. Perhaps we should be using confidence or trust, perhaps. I don't know. Perhaps faith has the wrong kind of connotation. But, you know, when we think about how we do anything in our life, we have to have a certain degree of faith about it. Even a scientist working in a laboratory has to have a certain faith, right? They read an article in a journal. Well, they have a certain faith that that research is accurate. They have a faith that the theorems that they were using are reasonably reliable. They have a faith that the equipment that they're using is going to measure things accurately. You use faith all the time, okay? But it's not absolute faith. Right? It's conditional faith, it's reasoned faith. And sometimes you find it's not true. Sometimes the theorem's wrong or the instrument's measuring wrongly. Sometimes what you before thought was true turns out to not be true. And then you change your mind. Okay? That's the key. Right? So there's no virtue. This comes to that idea I mentioned before. It's just somehow this idea that it's virtuous to believe in something in face of the facts. No, there's nothing virtuous about that. It's just delusional. If the facts disagree with your faith, change your faith. It's really basic, right? I mean, you do this for anything, you know? I mean, if you go down to the shop to buy some soy milk and you go to the shop and say, I'm going to buy some soy milk, and they say, we don't have any. And you say, but I believed that you had soy milk here. And they say, well, sorry, we don't. And then they say, well, I want soy milk. I believe there is soy milk. I feel this so intensely. You know, there is soy milk in this shop, you know. It's just delusional. Right? Why? This reality doesn't bend to our faith. Right? Our faith should bend to the reality. So this faith that we're practicing in Buddhism always should be this akaravati sadaha. Sometimes the spark of that faith, in fact, very often the spark of that faith is something which is not rational. And this is probably something that most people here will have experienced. Certainly I remember, you know, before I was a monk, even before I started practicing Buddhism, I can still cast my mind back. There's a few encounters with Buddhists. You know, I grew up in Perth in the 1980s, right? And Buddhists were rare and weird, right? And, I mean, the BSWA was here at the time, but I didn't know anything about it. And my first encounter really with a real live Buddhist was my friend Ross Bolitar, who some of you may know as one of the leaders of the Zen community in Perth these days. Ross was a muso, and he played with my band for a while. And, you know, one of the things that somebody told me that he was a Buddhist. We didn't even talk about Buddhism or something, but he always had a presence to him. You know, and one of the things that was noteworthy about Ross is, you know, if you're living a musician's life, you know, people are always drinking and smoking various substances and all of these kinds of things. And Ross would never do any of that kind of stuff. And yet he was the craziest of us all, right? He was the most innovative, creative, lively musician who I ever played with. And powered only by the spark of his own mind, his own heart. So I had some points of connection with Buddhism, which sort of in a way, you know, you creates a feel, like a feel of something positive or something about it, but I didn't really know anything about it. But then, you know, when you sort of went to a temple and looked at these things, somehow there's a feeling like coming home. There's a feeling of belonging, a feeling that, you know, I understand what this place is for, and I feel like this is right. And so I think we very often have that kind of positive emotional connection, and that's obviously a good thing. But we have to be a little bit careful with that as well. Because sometimes what happens, and certainly we find this in the Buddhist sphere, is that sometimes, you know, we are lost, right? We don't know what we're doing. We don't know what our life's about. We don't know what we believe in. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know. And then suddenly you find the Dhamma, and everything is so wonderful, right? And you've encountered real wisdom, yeah, and real peace, and real answers. Yeah? And it can be so overwhelming and make such an amazing impression, yeah? And it can really uplift you from that confusion. But sometimes what can happen is you can then get fixated on that. And this is something I think which is quite common in the Buddhist world, especially in like converted Buddhists. They get fixated on this kind of thing. You know, and like some monks you hear, they're always giving talks, oh, when I was a young monk. Oh, when I was a young monk. Oh, when I was a young... I first noticed this, somebody pointed it out to me. You know, they said, didn't... You know, they're listening to this one monk who's always talking like that, and they're like, didn't anything happen in your life since then? So, yeah, sure, of course it's okay to talk about those things from time to time, but that's not the end of your journey, right? That's the start of your journey. And you can see there's this like emotional fixation on those moments. Why? Because it was like salvation. It was when you found your path, right? So, of course, it's emotionally, it's very powerful. But if you get stuck there, then that just becomes another attachment, another crutch. So this is why this faith always has to be inquiring, always has to be growing. Yeah? So this is this Buddhist faith, this Buddhist sadha. So that faith in Buddhism is never meant to be it's never an outcome, it's never a final quality, it's always a starting point. Right? The first of the five faculties is faith. It's just to get you going. And, you know, there's some very interesting dialogues in the suttas when it talks about this specific point and the idea that faith is something which you should outgrow. In a sense, faith is an immature quality. There's one lovely dialogue where there's one of the leading laymen in the time of the Buddha, Cittagahapatiputta. And Cittagahapatiputta was a real character, actually. He used to sort of, invite monks to his house for dana, and then he used to ask them these really difficult Dhamma questions that they couldn't answer just to test them and to see how their practice was going. And he had really good meditation and so on as well. And this one time he was talking to this religious leader, and the religious leader said to him, you know, the Buddha, he teaches that you can get into this very state of profound peace of mind that they call jhana. And he said, that's ludicrous, that the kind of state doesn't exist. You know, and he asked Citta, he said, do you have faith in your teacher, the Buddha, when he talks about these very deep stages of meditation? And Citta said, no, I don't have any faith in the Buddha when he talks about those things. And then this religious leader said, you see, even his own followers don't believe him. Yeah? Even Gotama's own followers don't believe him, see? And then Citta said, yes, I don't have faith in the Buddha because I myself attain those states whenever I want to. So then he's like, oh, they're tricky, deceiving liars, these followers of the Buddha. But it shows you what that role of faith is, right? And faith is for something that you haven't seen. Once you've seen it, you don't need faith in it. You know it for yourself. And so all of you, and I think almost certainly every single person in this room, has had some experience of peace of mind. Even if it's only a little bit, even if it's only just a moment, where you were let go and then felt, yeah. And you can see that that's the Dhamma. That's the Four Noble Truths. Let go of craving and it's peaceful. Right? That's there, right, in your own mind. And you don't need me to tell you about that. You don't need Ajahn Brahm to tell you about that. You don't need to read about that in a sutta. You know that for yourself and nobody can take that away from you. You know for yourself. That's the real faith. If we're going to have faith in Buddhism, it's not faith in some external. We can say, oh, I have faith in the Buddha. Huh? Really, do you? Because the Buddha had faith in you. And if you're saying, I can't do it, oh, only the Buddha can help me, you don't have real faith in the Buddha. Because the Buddha had faith that you could do it. He said, I do not ask you to do what's impossible. If it was impossible to abandon what is unwholesome, I would not ask you to do it. But it is possible, and that's why I ask you. If it was impossible to develop what's wholesome, I would not ask you to do it. But it is possible. That's why I ask you to do it. So we've all seen this. We've all seen what it's like to abandon what's unwholesome, develop what's wholesome, to abandon suffering and develop happiness. That's the Dhamma. That's the Four Noble Truths. That's the reality which each of us have experienced in our own minds. And it's from that that we get faith. Ah, maybe there's something to this. Maybe this path does lead somewhere. When we hear the Buddha talking about dukkha, suffering, we know, suffering, yeah, that's me. I've suffered. I know what that is. And that longing to be free from suffering, yeah. And when you find that sense of recognition and contact, then that gives you a wish to practice. And this is the second of those spiritual faculties, the faculty of energy. Once we have that faith, that reasoned faith, then that promotes the energy to practice. And notice how different this is from blind faith. Right? Blind faith takes away your energy. Blind faith disempowers you. Blind faith says, there is nothing that you could do, so why bother? Just rely on someone else. Okay? Reasoned faith says, I can make a difference if I try, if I make some effort, if I put forth some energy. And this is something which has to be so constant, it has to be so persistent. Energy in Buddhism is not some mystical quality, it's not something which is extreme or anything like that. Energy is just what you do every day. Energy in Buddhism is just your persistence. Yeah? The way that energy is described in Buddhism is always very simple. So when you see something unwholesome, you abandon it. You see something wholesome, you develop it. That's all. Right? It's not talking about anything mysterious. Not talking about any kind of, you know, extreme effort or anything like that. Just to be able to consistently abandon what's unwholesome and develop what's wholesome. This is that energy. And if we can do that, and we practice our energy, then our mind will gradually become purified and our meditation will become deeper. Now, of course, these five spiritual faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, wisdom, they are not solely talking about meditation. Obviously, we can apply them in every aspect of our life, but the sort of core application of them is to your meditation practice, right? Especially through energy, and then the next one, development of mindfulness. Now, mindfulness in this context is about how we develop. The essence of mindfulness is the idea of continuity, presence. Mindfulness is what connects, gives a flow to our awareness, There's a lovely definition of mindfulness in an Abhidhamma book called the Abhidharma Samuchaya by a Sangha. He defines mindfulness as the repeated calling to mind of a previously experienced object. The repeated calling to mind of a previously experienced object. And when you hear that definition, you think, hang on, that's not, you know, I thought mindfulness was just being aware of whatever happens. It's often how it's described these days. It's not quite correct. And mindfulness is really closely connected with the idea of memory. And that actual connection is there in this five spiritual faculties. The spiritual faculty of mindfulness is sometimes defined as the ability to recollect what was said and done long ago. So it makes sense if you think of it, just think of it in the context of breath meditation. Okay? You're sitting down there, your legs are crossed, ready to meditate, close your eyes, turn your mind inwards, and you hold the breath in mind. You keep your mindfulness with your breathing. Right? So this is that quality of mindfulness, which is that quality of keeping that breath in mind. It's Venerable Tanisaro's rendering of anapanasati, which I think is quite a good one. Keeping the breath in mind, anapanasati. And so this idea of keeping on and on and on. Anupassana, the word that's used always in the context of mindfulness in the suttas is anupassana. It means to keep on watching something. And so this is your mindfulness. It's not like, oh, I'm aware of this and I'm aware of that and I'm aware of the other. It's to keep on watching at that same place. So the word mindfulness in the suttas is actually very close in meaning simply to meditation. Of course it's used more broadly than that, but very often it's used to mean just meditation. Anapanasati, keeping your breath in mind. So you have that faith that gives you that inspiration, that emotional connection, feeling that, this is what I want to be doing. This gives a meaning for my life. This gives me a direction. Gives me a purpose. And then so to do that, then you put forth the effort. You realize that this is not going to just happen. It's not just an accident, but it happens through effort. I have to try. You put forth the effort, and then you apply your mindfulness, develop meditation, keeping your breath in mind, or whatever meditation object that you're developing. And as we're practicing meditation, as we're deepening our awareness, you know, all kinds of things happen in meditation. And we've got used to these days, you know, people talk about the different benefits of meditation, and you know, you can get health benefits from meditation, which is very true. And you can get, you know, psychological benefits, you get peace of mind and freedom from anxiety and so on and so forth. So lots of different benefits that you can get from meditation. And again, this is something I think most of us have seen. We will be able to see that meditation has those benefits. But if we look in the suttas, we look at how the Buddha taught the main benefit of meditation. The most important one was that meditation, mindfulness, leads to samadhi. Okay, so mindfulness is not something which is an end in itself. Mindfulness is just another step on the journey, just like faith is, just like energy is. Mindfulness is a step towards something deeper. And that deeper thing is what we call samadhi. Now, normally samadhi is translated, or very often it's translated as concentration. And hopefully, I think Ajahn Brahm has talked about this on many occasions, so hopefully you will have banished that translation from your vocabulary. Henceforth, never let it be spoken. Mindfulness doesn't mean concentration. In fact, there is virtually no overlap between those two words. It's not merely inadequate. It's just wrong. If you think about concentration, the usual word, most common way that we use the word concentrate in English is if the kids are sitting at the back of the classroom not paying attention, you say concentrate, right? And so to concentrate basically means to make yourself pay attention to something which is intrinsically boring. Right? That's how we use it, isn't it, right? To concentrate on something. Oh, I'm really trying hard to concentrate. You know, somebody asked me before I came in, how do I learn to concentrate? I have to do my PhD, you know, and I've got this really important work to do and stuff. But then there's this, you know, thing called the internet, you know, and and PhD is boring and the internet is fun, right? So how do you concentrate on that, right? So it means, how do you make yourself focus on something which is intrinsically boring, right? And so, you know, this is where it's not, again, this word concentration, it's not merely, you know, incorrect translation, but it makes a huge difference in how people actually meditate, in what people do with their minds when they sit and close their eyes and they think they're doing meditation. They try to concentrate. They try to pay attention to this or that. They try to watch their breath. They try to do this and they try. And it doesn't work. And they're like, what's up? Oh, meditation's so hard. Oh, it's so difficult. Oh, it's so suffering. I've got to try even harder. Oh, I've got to, maybe I'll find another method. Maybe I'll find another teacher. Maybe I'll do some other retreat. No, it's just a wrong-headed approach to meditation, okay? It's not about concentration, okay? And that's not what samadhi means. Think about what samadhi meant. The Buddha was teaching in an Indian context, of course. Samadhi is an Indian word. What does samadhi mean in the culture, in the Indian culture? Okay. Now, in Hinduism, if you ask any Hindu what samadhi means, samadhi means that the transcendental union of this little self, this little consciousness, with the divine consciousness that is the entire cosmos. Okay. It's becoming one with God. That's what samadhi is, okay? Samadhi is the transcendent of your little personal existence to become one with the divine cosmos. Is that concentration? Right? No, it's not even anywhere near it. When Buddhists use the word samadhi, they mean exactly the same thing. Of course, in Buddhism, we don't have the same metaphysical explanation of it. We don't talk about it in terms of self and God and these kinds of things. But we're talking about the same kind of experience, okay? It's just from a Buddhist point of view, we prefer to describe that experience in psychological terms rather than in metaphysical terms. So instead of talking about God and the self and things like that, we talk about peace of mind. We talk about radiance. We talk about bliss. We talk about oneness. These are all experiences. And these are experiences that characterize that thing we call samadhi. Okay? So never think of samadhi as concentration or the way to samadhi as being concentration or anything like that. Samadhi is a transcendental oneness, a unification. And what samadhi means is oneness on many different levels. It means that you have a oneness that your mind is only doing one thing. Okay, so the mind's unified in that way. It means also that there's only one kind of consciousness. So normally in Buddhism we think of six kinds of consciousness, right? Visual, auditory, smell, taste, touch, and the mind. Right? So in samadhi is oneness, ekagata. That means that all of those other kinds of consciousness have come to an end. Yeah? Only mind consciousness. No seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting, no touching. This is unity. But also, as well as those kinds of unity, it also means a kind of unity in time. Right? It doesn't change. It's static for that period, or virtually static. And so this is why this kind of experience is often described or said to be eternal. People will talk about the eternal consciousness or that experience of eternity. And the reason why it feels like eternity is very simple. It's because normally we measure time by the changing of our minds. Right? Time isn't something that exists objectively in the world. Time is just, our minds change. Things, our thoughts change. We look in different places. We think of different things. We have different experiences. And when those experiences are changed, we use time as a framework for making sense of those things. So time is an inference that we draw from our memories of the changes in consciousness. But when our consciousness is not changing anymore, when all there is this one single present, then there's no time. Time doesn't exist. It's a meaningless concept. So for that period, it's like time is suspended and it feels like eternity. So this is some of the meanings of this word samadhi that we talk about. So in practicing Dhamma, you know, you practice faith, you practice energy, you practice mindfulness, and these things lead up to samadhi. And samadhi is a state that is born of letting go. Vo sagga ramanang karitva labhati samadhi lagbati chittase kagatang. Based on letting go, one gains samadhi, one gains unification of mind. Vo sagga ramanang karitva. Based on letting go. So samadhi is not something which, you know, it's not about using this particular method or that particular method or meditating for this many hours a day or at this place or, you know, going to Burma and doing some retreat or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's about letting go. And letting go is not dependent on time or place. It's not dependent on this method or that method or anything like that. You just have to let go. And if you can't let go here and now, what makes you think that you're going to go somewhere else and let go then? Yeah. Why don't you just let go now? That's the basis of samadhi. And once you learn this, and you learn what letting go is, you realize that actually it's very easy. I don't know what this is. People always tell me meditation, oh, I can't stop thinking. So easy to stop thinking. You just stop. You just sit there and don't think. What's your problem? I don't know. You sit there and you stop thinking and it's peaceful. You're like, oh, that's nice. You just let go. It's so easy. That's what samadhi comes. It's this ease and this being relaxed. And samadhi is a kind of an outcome of this process of faith, energy, mindfulness, tranquility, ease, joy, happiness, all of these things building up. And you're just peaceful. You don't want to do anything else. You know? Even when we just a minute ago, we were doing the guided meditation before the talk, you know? Yeah, you know, I'm doing this guided meditation, you know, I can't really meditate properly, I have to, you know, we have to do it together. And they were still, oh, what is your point? Oh, I'm very, really peaceful now, maybe we don't, do we have to have a Dhamma talk tonight? Maybe we could just keep going. And so this samadhi, you know, as we find it, it's something which is not, it's not tense, it's not concentrated, it's not hard. It's very, very soft, it's very big. The Buddha said, make your mind like as vast as the great ocean. Right? Make your mind as big as the sky. Right? And you look at a lot of the problems that we have, and people talk about the problems they have in meditation, and they're so worried about this, and they're so, what do they look like, or what does, you know, what did so-and-so say about me, or can I get that job, or can I do these things, and all of these things, and they're so small. All of these worries that obsess our mind, and that's what these worries do. They shrink your mind around them. They draw your mind in and make it tight, and you think this thing is so, so important. You've got to sort it out. So the solution is not to solve the problem. The solution is to make your mind bigger. If when your consciousness is bigger, your mind is bigger, all those little problems, you see them for what they are. Yeah. It's just a little thing. It doesn't mean it's nothing. You still can pay attention to it. You can still address it and so on. But the world is so much bigger than that. Your mind is so much bigger than that. And so this is that samadhi, is that ocean of the mind like the sky. Make your mind as broad as the great earth, the Buddha said. That's samadhi, that's not concentration. So finally we come to the last of these faculties, wisdom. Yeah? So faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, wisdom. Panya. And wisdom in Buddhism and in the context of the five indriyas is usually talked about in terms of understanding impermanence. Understanding rise and fall. But understanding impermanence is not just about understanding that something's there and then it's not. Okay, this is a trivial understanding of impermanence. But really understanding permanence is about understanding the nature of things. It's about understanding conditions. It's about understanding patterns. How things work. And particularly, you know, because you know the wisdom is the final factor, the maturing factor, it's a wisdom which unifies all of the other factors in the five indriyas. Right? Wisdom's the unifying factor. And the Buddha described it like the rafter, the ridgepole of a building. If you have the four rafters, is like the four faculties. Yeah? Faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, these are like the four poles holding the roof up, and then the ridge pole at the top of the roof, this is wisdom. And it's wisdom that locks everything else into place. So wisdom sees and understands, this is how these faculties work. They condition each other, they support each other. Somebody who has faith will develop energy. Someone who has energy will develop mindfulness. Someone who has mindfulness will develop samadhi. Someone who has samadhi, yatha bhudanyana dasanang, will know and see things as they really are. So these things always come, they're always connected. They always come together. Wisdom is the one that draws everything together and makes it whole. And somebody who has wisdom, has that really deep wisdom, ultimately can transcend that need for faith. That's when the faith has become confirmed. In Buddhism, they use the Pali term is avecchapasada. It's another very interesting one. It's faith. The literal meaning of avecha is literally to have gone under something, right? Literally to have gone underneath something. Right? So this is literally is the faith that comes from having undergone it yourself. Right? The faith of undergoing. The faith of your own personal experience. Again, I'm quoting the Pali here, so you know I'm not just making these things up. Avecha pasada. Right? That's the important kind of faith. Not the blind faith. The faith of experience. And so when you put these things into practice, you see how they work and you reflect back on them. You develop your understanding. And this is why when I do the guided meditations, I always do at the end of the meditations like a reflection. It's called Pachavekana, reviewing. You look back, you see patterns, cause and effect, how the meditation flows, how it changes, what thoughts led to what feelings generated what thoughts, how your perception moved. All of these things, you reflect back, you look at that, and you learn to understand how your mind works. And so with that wisdom, then all of those faculties come together. And then this is what leads to the maturity of the path and the growth of the path. So anyway, so this is my talk for this evening on the five spiritual faculties, Panchindriyani, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And I'm hoping that if I just say these often enough, you will remember them. Anyway, it is a good thing to remember, and it's a nice one to use. I didn't even get to talk about how to practice with it. I should actually just mention that briefly before wrapping up, but how do you practice with it? Well, many ways, but one way that you can do it is when you're meditating, at the beginning of your meditation, you call this set of dhammas to mind, each one of them, and you ask, do I have this inside me? Where can I find this inside me? Where can I find faith? Where can I find energy? Where can I find mindfulness? Where can I find samadhi? Where can I find wisdom? Even just a little bit. Doesn't have to be strong or perfect, just a little bit. And when you look inside like that, you realize, actually I do have some faith. I do have some energy, right? If you're sitting on a meditation cushion, you must have some energy. I mean, you're not sleeping yet. I mean, you might be sleeping in a few minutes, but you've got enough energy to sit meditation. That's enough. mindfulness, all of these things. So you look first and you remind yourself, oh, actually, I do have these things in me. This is what the Buddha said. He said that these qualities are the qualities that lead to liberation. Right? And so then you give yourself that faith and that inspiration, that confidence to be able to practice. So this is one way that you can use to consciously call up and develop these faculties at the beginning of your meditation. Okay, so that's enough for now. Maybe we might have some questions. Any questions from the floor? I've just told you that. Just told you that inquiry is so important. I hope you don't take anything I said on blind faith. But you must inquire. Yeah, Nick. Mike.
Just relating to that comment about you were saying about just stop thinking.
Yeah.
Do we really have control over what thoughts come up or whether they come up? I was wondering if you could expand on that.
Do we have control? No, it's not control. It's just conditions. Yeah, if you understand conditions. But in an ordinary sense, if you say, "Do you have control over it?" then yes. Yeah, if you can make a decision, it's not a matter of forcing it to not, you know. But if you want to say, "I just don't want to think," then you can just stop. It's easy. You don't believe me, but it's true. Okay, another one. No, okay, we have iPad questions. Okay, Michelle from France. How's it going, Michelle? Bande, isn't right faith equal to reason plus intuition? Reason plus intuition. I'm not entirely sure, yeah. Well, it's certainly connected with those things. I don't know if I'd say it's equivalent to them. Faith. When we think of faith, we think more of to me, reason and intuition are two sides of wisdom and how we find wisdom. You know, we can find wisdom either by sort of using some kind of logical method and analyzing things and so on, or you find wisdom through just realizing the truth. Actually, both of these things always work together in real wisdom. So faith is one of the things that makes those things possible. I wouldn't necessarily say it's the same thing. It's certainly related to them. So Johnny from the USA. How's it going, Johnny? Are some people doomed to not be able to achieve faith in anything? Speaking personally as someone who's left Christianity and now reads the suttas, I find much to question. Good. Yes, good. Achieve faith by questioning. Yeah. And, there's a lovely saying which we find many times in the suttas that when, say, for example, some of the monks might hear some people talking about something and it uses this phrase that says, neither accepting nor rejecting what was said, we shall inquire as to the meaning. Right? That is the kind of thing that you can have faith in, right? That's what you can, you know, when you read the suttas or you look at the Buddha's teachings, you don't have to believe everything, right? You're not going to have we don't have like kind of tests that's going to check whether whether your belief in Buddhism is doctrinally correct or anything like that. But there's things like that. When you read, you see things like that, you say, oh, okay, yes, that's right, isn't it? There's a spark of reality, a spark of truth there. That's that kind of poise that says, you know, you don't have to have an opinion about everything. It's okay to say, oh, I'll put that to one side. I'll see if I can find out. Right? And so when you if you're interested to read the suttas, that's great. And of course you'll find things to question. That's good. Question them. And but maybe you'll also find things that strike you as being reasonable and take those things and practice them, and that's where your faith will come. So no, I don't think that you're doomed to be without faith. I think it's just that road towards real faith, towards akaravati sadha. It's a long road, that's all. So just enjoy it. Okay, Tore from Norway, how's it going? Should we assume that we already have a basis of faith, considering that we're born into this situation of seeking out the Dhamma? Yes, I think there's probably something to that. I think that, it's difficult to generalize, but I certainly, most of us probably have some kind of past life connection or something like that. And there's a tendency, a sort of a recognition. But whether or not that's the case, I mean, that's ultimately that's not really important. The main thing is whether the Dhamma is helping us to overcome suffering. So that, you know, in terms of the initial inspiration and being there, then those past conditions can be useful. But the real thing that matters is, can you let go of suffering? And if you can do that, then that's where the real faith will come from. Okay. So, I believe that's all for this evening. We should probably wrap up by paying respects to the Triple Gem.